Hi, I'm Lori Hennessy, and I'm the CEO of League of Education Voters, and this is Washington Game Changers. It's a podcast we've been doing for about 6 months now or so. We're talking to people in the community who do a lot of good. And this month, we're talking to Angela Griffin. Hello, Angela.
Hi, Lori. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Oh, it's so great to have you. I have to be honest and say that Angela and I have many degrees of separation. So I used to be on the Treehouse board where I first got to know Angela, and we'll talk about her history working with Treehouse and all the great stuff she's done, and I'll allow her to introduce herself. But I have to take credit because we worked together at Treehouse, and one day I was like, oh my God, she would be amazing. And at the time I worked at the zoo, and then Angela was pulled into the zoo board, and you're still on the zoo board.
I'm still on the zoo board. And what was interesting is that you took the challenge at Treehouse to help diversify our board with, you know, requests that I had. And you're like, okay, so now trying to get some diversity on my board, you know, I'm challenging you as well. So it was cool. And I'm still there on the Woodland Park Zoo board.
Yeah. And I think about you all the time because a part of me always misses. I used to work at the zoo before I came to League of Education Voters. And I tell people all the time, I never took advantage enough of having a meeting, walk outside, go have the meeting in front of the penguins. Of course, that was all in before times when people even really had meetings in the same place. So in the meantime, Angela and I also are colleagues and friends, and I just think there's no one better than you to come and talk about some of the good you've done in the community. So first of all, let's go ahead and introduce you. This is Angela. I'll let you tell folks a little bit about yourself, where you are now and where you've been.
Thanks, Lori. So I have been working in the nonprofit sector, I always say the service sector, for about 28 years now. I started my career with early learning, and now I am back 360 degree in the early learning sector 28 years later. And it's just been an amazing journey for me. The majority of my work has been with children and youth and families, and wanting to make sure that they have equitable access to all types of experiences. You know, I've always wanted children at the earliest ages to be able to learn and grow. I've wanted to make sure that they are able to have fun experiences. So I ran programs with the Boys and Girls Club and with the YMCA. I actually took a little stint of teaching. I was a middle school social studies teacher.
I never knew that.
I taught 6th, 7th, and 8th grade history and social studies. And so that was when I had this aspiration of being a school superintendent. And what they required was that you taught in the classroom for a certain period of time and kind of work yourself up administratively. But I learned pretty quickly that was not the work for me. It was not what brought me a whole lot of joy. And I went back into the nonprofit sector where I could actually make sure kids were having their social emotional learning needs met, and again having enriching activities, engaging opportunities outside of the classroom. And that has just been really fulfilling. Now I did fulfill my dream of being a top level leader in a school district because I became a school board director. Yes. So I took, instead of being a superintendent, I took on the role of being able to hire and fire the superintendent and work in partnership with the superintendent as a leader. And that was.
My husband was on a school board. I think we've talked about that before. Yes. And boy, you know, once you've had someone in your life who's been in a school board, you just have such deep appreciation for that work.
Yes.
So, all right. So then you're at Launch. Tell us about Launch.
Yeah. So now I'm at Launch, and Launch is one of the larger preschool providers in the city of Seattle. We also provide after school programming in public schools. So we're in 12 school buildings in the Seattle Public School District, and then also in a couple of community centers where we provide early learning and after school enrichment and summer programs. And that's my full circle, you know, back around to this sector But I did prior to joining Launch, and I joined Launch like in the middle, actually at the start of the pandemic, right? Crazy making, but I did it. And but prior to that, you know, I had worked for Treehouse, which is where I was able to step in right at the beginning of launching a hairy, audacious goal, as we named it, in helping youth in foster care across the state graduate from high school on time or with extended time. And that was just amazing work. And then this challenge came up with the childcare sector. Like at the beginning of the pandemic, there was all this talk about the sector needing to be sustained and you know, kids being impacted and families being impacted by not having access to childcare and quite a bit of outreach. And I said, okay, I love a challenge. So I stepped right in and have been able to do quite a bit around advocacy and for funding for childcare and for us to be able to keep our spaces and school buildings and just, you know, really sustain the sector so families can keep working and having access to childcare.
It's so funny because I was remembering just a random memory of you presenting once at a Treehouse board meeting. And I think it might have been 5 or 6 years ago, but I think it might have been the first time that I had heard very much about disproportionality in terms of kids in foster care and kids of color in our school systems. And I know this is an unfair, huge question to ask, just to ask you to talk a little bit about that, because I remember at the time I'm embarrassed. I was like, whoa. And of course now where I am now, it's just every day you hear more. And I'm sure there are some people out there who still don't believe this is something that exists in our school systems and in pre-K and early learning, but tell me more about that area of focus for you.
Well, you know, so that became a big part of my life's work is acknowledging that our children of color or children who are marginalized in a variety of ways. So experiencing foster care, experiencing homelessness, our children who are LGBTQ plus are, you know, whatever the identity factor that doesn't match up to what's considered dominant or the norm, our children tend to struggle more and be placed in situations where they're not receiving the same access or they're disproportionately disciplined. So, you know, they're identified quicker with discipline issues and their discipline may be managed in a different way, put into special education programs when, you know, they may not really have full identifiers that should have them in those spaces. And so with our youth in foster care, very similar, when a call is made to CPS, they're kids who are children of color or from other marginalized areas are removed quicker from the home and placed into someone else's home. And then they continue to be marginalized, continue to be disenfranchised. And so that's where I have had the opportunity to call that out, to name it and say, let's handle those situations in a very different way. Let's first take into consideration who we are talking about and then what we are going to do to ensure that they are successful in spite of the situation they find themselves in.
Well, and you referred to it in the beginning of this conversation, just you look at boards everywhere and they tend to be wealthy people, white people. I have to stop saying this, but Karens, I always point at myself. Say Karens, just because demographically, you know, that's who's on boards and you have this world where those people are making all kinds of decisions based on very little information or life experience. And I've often thought of friends of mine like you coming into that room, you know, and speaking the truth and saying, here's what I know, here's what I've lived, and looking at that sea of people in suits, you know.
Yes. Well, I've shared my own lived experience and the lived experience of my children and family members and my community, right? I can share a variety of stories. And then recently I completed my doctorate degree and I decided to do research on it, right? Some people need data. You know, one of the norms is that, you know, if you don't have the data to back it, then you're just telling the story. And so, so I did some research so that I can present data to demonstrate that there is a gap in who is at the table where decisions are being made, and these stories are being shared, and then there are resources or time allocated to make a change or shift the way the systems are impacting our children and our families. And as you pointed out, the majority of the time, those people at those tables are white. And when you're talking about the nonprofit sector, mainly white women. And in our state and in the state of Washington, particularly in Seattle and Western Washington, many of our white women are, wanting to help and wanting to support and have good hearts, right? And it turns into the savior complex of, right, like I can rescue you, I can make things better for you. And it's still through your lens, right? It's still through your experience. And the shift comes when you're actually able to listen and learn from the lived experience of the people you want to help, and then make those shifts and those transitions based on what they are telling you they need, right? So, you know, I remember we did an activity with the Treehouse board where actually you had to take a little step back and think about what is the experience of the other and hear what was needed, and then come up with a solution based on what they said they wanted. And that's always the hardest thing to do. It's hard.
I remember, I just look at you and I have so many memories of you speaking truth in those meetings, which is just, you know, difficult for people to do in other circumstances as well. But wow, I just always sat back going, I guess.
Well, I remember a meeting when I said, you know, I'm experiencing these microaggressions. You were like, what is a microaggression and what did I do?
I remember that too. Like, I don't know what it is. What is that? Was actually the meeting I was remembering where, you know, the bravery to look at a room of people. So what are some of the specifics in terms of your doctoral work? You were saying we have to change how it operates. I mean, what's an example of what we change in the nonprofit system to make it a system where people can actually thrive?
Well, so one way is, you know, recently in probably the past 5 years, maybe a little bit longer, there's been acknowledgement of who is leading the nonprofit organizations, right? And acknowledging that they're majority white women. And so then we have these leaders who are saying, okay, it's time for me to step away, or it's time for, or I have the opportunity to build my leadership team or grow my board. And so there needs to be intentionality of setting a goal to diversify in those experiences. And so if you are going to leave your role as the, you know, the executive of your organization, then being intentional about identifying what it would look like for a leader of color to step into your shoes. And if you're looking at your board demographics over the next year, and you see that, okay, well, we have, you know, 10% of our board are leaders of color, even 25, even 30, even 40, right? How do we continue to increase that number? And what's the intentional effort we're going to make to bring in board members who are diverse in a variety of identities? And then the same with the opportunity to hire in new staff, right? If you have your director of finance leaves, your director of HR, anyone that's at that leadership table where decisions are being made, then being very intentional about identifying a person of color. And sometimes what it takes is time, right? Like, you get this sense of urgency. I have to fill this position. I got to get a board member. We have to hire for a new ED. And then we don't get any diverse candidates because we didn't diversify our approaches for looking for them. And so we just take what we get. We're settled. And really, you have to take, we, it's necessary to take the time to actually open up the doors. And for many leaders of color, there's distrust, right? Mm-hmm. So being prepared to answer questions and being proactive in providing some of the answers that leaders of color may have, but not necessarily know how to ask for. Yeah.
And how do we make someone successful when you're in the organization? You come into the organization, which is still steeped in that old culture. And like, it's that one training that everyone I know talks about, where it's like the characteristics of white supremacy culture that we're all learning. And one of them is need for closure. And like at the end of every meeting, I always say, okay, to summarize everything we've decided. So you look at those characteristics of those cultures that already exist, where there's this white dominance, and then you bring in someone. How do we help someone be successful in that culture where we're expecting someone to change their essential truth and personality to fit what we've already set?
Right. Well, another reality about those cultural norms is that many of us, many people of color, have been steeped in those norms, right? And so I learned, if I'm going to be successful in an organization, then I need to have a sense of urgency. I need to make sure my written word is strong. I need to make sure that I'm tracking quantity. Like, I learned those norms are what it's going to take for me to be successful. Mm-hmm. And so I am always going to, I may be dispositioned to look for an organization that's going to fit my ability to be successful based on those norms. And so the opportunity that comes in is that when you are interviewing someone to be in your organization, that you actually really listen and understand what cultural norms they're bringing in, and then determine whether or not you can shift the organization culture to make sure that person is successful, right? And so it just requires a listening, an engaging, asking the right questions, and then determining whether or not it's going to be a good fit on both ends. And what I am challenging organizations to do is then be able to stretch in both ways, right? So the leader needs to be able to stretch themselves to actually to support the culture that exists, because the majority of the people have been steeped in that culture, and an organization needs to stretch itself to adapt to some of the cultural ways that a leader of color is going to come into the organization. So it's just kind of the space of meeting in the middle, right? And growing together.
What do we do? You know, I was, I think you and I talked about it, how my last, or the first podcast I did for this was with Dr. Ben Danielson. And we were talking about a lot of these issues. And at one point, we were planning an annual event. And so he was going to be part of that as well. And as we were planning the event, we said, okay, let's talk about breakout rooms that we'll have after the discussion. Mm-hmm. And so I said, can the breakout rooms, one of the questions be three things I can do tomorrow? And suffice it to say, it's now become a running joke with Dr. Ben, that was my instinct, was to say, what's three things to do tomorrow? Mm-hmm. Rather than, wow, we have many, many, many miles ahead to learn what we've done, to learn what we're still doing. And when I say we, I mean white people, to do better, to be better. So here we are in this time of reckoning where everyone, you know, well, not everyone, sadly, many people are struggling trying to be better. Many people are not. And I keep struggling as a person in my community with how to make this last. You know, to quote Dr. Ben, to not just say, okay, great, well, that was a little thing that was in the news. How do we continue this work? And that's a huge question. But I mean, what are your thoughts about how do we actually continue this dialogue and not stop the dialogue, as history shows us we often do?
We do that. We continue the dialogue, right? Like, continuing to create spaces where the dialogue can happen. And you know, and I've talked to you about this place of sponsorship. Mm-hmm. Like you have a platform. Mm-hmm. And so creating, ensuring that you have people coming to this platform as often as possible to keep the conversation going, and where other place people have platforms, then to use them. I mean, like, you know, we have all these foundations with, mm-hmm. with resources, and we have all these corporations with resources. Like, use your resources to keep the conversation going. Use your networks to build more networks, so then we can keep the conversation going. And you know, Lori, it's so, that sponsorship piece is so important, yeah. right? Because you have had the opportunity to try and fail and try and fail. And when you talk about a leader of color coming into an organization, whether it's on a board or an executive team or whatever, like usually we only get one time mm-hmm. to try. And if we fail, then we're out the door, right? We don't always get the chance over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. So as a sponsor, you have the opportunity to create that space mm-hmm. where you are advocating for that leader, right? You are saying, I believe in this individual, and I believe that they can be successful, and I am right alongside them along the way, right? If you ever have a question or a concern, call me up before you make a decision to, you know, to not keep them there. Call me and let's talk about it, mm-hmm. because you can understand their language yeah. better than I can understand it, right? And help navigate those spaces. That sponsorship piece is critical yeah. right now. And I've also shared, I see it as an opportunity of reparations, right? Mm-hmm. So people, when we say reparations, some people start tinging and they're like, oh my gosh, they want money and land from us. No, right? Like that doesn't have to be the only way. And there's been several articles and mm-hmm. information out there around reparations where, no, we need time and we need access mm-hmm. and we need sponsorship and mentors, and you have the opportunity to give that back now, right? And that's valuable. That's so very valuable.
All right, so I always ask this, a couple questions here that I have to ask, so this is popcorn. Tell mm-hmm. me one book or one author, one thing that gives you hope, or that we might be able to share with people to give them hope, because this is a tough time for a lot of people.
Oh, goodness, a book or author? Oh my.
Or a movie or a poem. Anything that would give people hope.
Well, I can share a book that was shared with me in the past couple of years that has been very validating for me and helpful for me
yeah.
is Whistling Vivaldi by Claude Steele.
I've heard of this. I did not read it. It's
Because it provides that understanding, mm-hmm. a cultural understanding mm-hmm. of stereotypes
yeah.
and the threat of stereotypes. And when a leader of color like myself walks mm-hmm. into a space that I'm automatically thinking about the stereotypes against me. Are they concerned I'm going to be an angry Black woman? Are they concerned that I'm not going to be as intellectual as I need to be? Like those stereotypes are there already. And then there's a way we need to work past them mm-hmm. so that I can be successful and the organization can continue to be successful. But it requires acknowledging them up front. And that's a great book.
All right, that's on my list. And yeah. you're a mom, right? How many kids?
Four children.
And yeah. so looking back, the other thing I always, what's one thing that you would say to parents out there? Because you juggled so much when your kids were little, I know. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of parents who watch and listen to our podcast. What's one thing you would say, looking back at that journey, just that you give as advice to parents who you meet?
Well, so as an educator, so I you know, my first degree is in child development, and so it's really, it's important to acknowledge that each of our children are unique, And so systems would try to put them in boxes and compare mm-hmm. them to each other. Mm-hmm. And as a parent, I have found value in identifying the unique characteristic of each of my children. So I don't compare my four children at all. They don't even all look alike to me. Right? People will say, well, that child sounds like that child. And so, but to me, they sound different. They look different. They smell different. They act different. They do everything. And I have, I've just embraced that for them and tried to help them embrace that. So then they have found themselves not comparing themselves to others in the world, in the classroom. Am I matching up to someone in my classroom or the expectations that others may have on them that they may not be able to live up to?
That's great. And then as a former school board director back in your day, any advice to anyone who's thinking about getting into that line of volunteer work?
Oh, please do. Please. Like we need people. So I'll say from a school political perspective, mm-hmm. Many times our school board seats go unchallenged, right? People will let school board directors sit there for 20 years mm-hmm. and continuing to have the same conversations in these school board meetings. And so in any political position, and it's hard to put yourself out there. You have to be very vulnerable, but it's important to try. And sometimes try again. And it's hard. I am actually a contender for a state board of education seat right now.
Oh my gosh, I forgot about, oh, that's great.
So I will know on Friday if I re-won, because I did win and there wasn't a big enough margin. So we had to open it back up.
So. Oh, that's so wonderful. Oh, I just realized that we're going to run this next week. So I will share that in the notes.
Yes.
Fingers crossed. Okay. So then final, back to early learning, and then I'm going to let you get on with what undoubtedly is a crazy day. Why should it matter to people to support organizations that provide early learning to kids? How important is this to kids?
This is where it starts. This is where the education starts for our young ones. And I believe parents are the first educator. And so, what we teach in the home is the most valuable. And when children have the opportunity to learn outside of the home and be prepared for the K-12 education system, then programs like Launch and some of my other colleagues in the community are vital to our children's development and our growth. And the other piece of it, we say early learning, we say school age, but childcare in general is a necessity right now to rebuild our economy. Mm-hmm. For families to get back to work, they need childcare. And so we need to have some more investments in the opportunity for kids to be cared for in high quality programs so families can work.
What do people do if they want to learn more about Launch or even, I don't know, donate to Launch? What do they do? Well,
please go to www.launchlearning.org and contribute to our great work. We would welcome it.
All right. I am going to stay tuned after we end this so we can say goodbye after I shut off the recording. But I just wanted to say thank you so much. You inspire me. And I love every time I talk to you, and thank you for all you do.
Thank you, Lori. Thank you for your boldness to create this space and ensure that leaders of color like myself have a platform to speak and engage community.
All right. Angela Griffin, thank you for being with us, and Happy New Year to you.
Same to you.